The United States has started to incur casualties again in this war. It seemed that it was casualty-free for a long time, especially when we're on, I believe it's the 11th consecutive day, which basically means we've gone back to war. But the question is, was that an aberration? Was that something unusual? Or can we expect more? Is there a chance for a mass casualty effect? And if so, what would that do to the war? Would that cause the American people to get more angry and want to go deeper? Or would it have sort of the Vietnam effect and make people say, what the hell are we doing? Let's get out. We're going to talk about that and a lot more today because there's so many things going on here. Some things you may not be aware of. And of course, we have the amazing Joe Kent, former director of National Counterterrorism Center, and just an all around great guy to be on the show today. So, Joe, welcome to the show, first of all.
Hey, Danny, great to be with you, man. Thanks.
Well, listen, let's jump right into this here because you've been talking about the potential for a mass casualty event, given that we just had, you know, most of the people on the mainstream media stuff is just focused on the casualties that they existed. And of course, the president's saying, oh, we're going to avenge them. And Secretary Hegseth is saying we're going to avenge them. And so, but what are you concerned about?
Just the basic math of having troops out there in exposed positions that the enemy knows exactly where they are. And now the Iranians have proven that they can penetrate our defenses. And so, yeah, do we shoot down most of the things they shoot at us? Yes, we do. But it's basic math. We have to be lucky every single second of every single day. The Iranians only have to be lucky once. By hitting that base in Jordan with those ballistic missiles, they showed us that, like, look, they can reach pretty deep because Jordan's it's a good deal away from Iran. And so they basically showed us that if they wanted to, they could reach out and touch something that would, you know, tip off a mass casualty event like one of our ships. I understand our ships have, you know, sophisticated and adequate armament and the ability to defend themselves. But again, if they were swarmed with drones, with ballistics, would they be able to do that? So I am afraid that the longer we stay in the region, the more we are inviting a mass casualty situation. And then we won't be able to say, hey, we just did a couple retaliation strikes and now we're done. Then we'll be, you know, fully into this war, and then we'll be in this blood debt where we have to stay and avenge our fallen for quite some time. The president did several days worth of retaliatory strikes for the three that we just lost recently, plus the one up in Iraq. And I think right now the prudent thing for him to do is to say, hey, I've got no good ground options. I've got no good military options. We can stay here and bleed longer and invite more risk. Or right now the president could say, hey, we're done. We, you know, declare victory and leave. I'm afraid he's not going to do that because of what we're seeing him say now publicly. I'm afraid that we're going to double and triple down. And we're just like, we're inviting that opportunity for a mass casualty situation that's only going to get us sucked further into this thing. So that's the top of my concerns right now. There's some other concerning stuff that we can get into that the Israelis said earlier today that we should look at too.
Yeah, definitely want to get to that too. I want to stick on this issue here because it's not even the math seems to be getting worse. Not even just like, well, we're knocking down everything or most things, but apparently we're knocking down less and less because the Iranian side has been, there's a lot of satellite imagery out there now that's showing they have pinpoint accuracy. Whatever's getting shot down, I don't know, but what's getting through is dead on target. This information was just out today. This is Mario Nafal, released this earlier today, said in the aftermath of the Iranian missile strikes on the U.S. facilities in the Middle East, and I think by that he means the Jordan one where the casualties occurred, he said from U.S. soldiers themselves, here's what one of them said. From what I'm hearing, and we're getting projected impact data, but the missiles are changing trajectory multiple times in flight so that the projected impact warnings are no good. Targeting data is obviously getting fed to Iran from China or Russia. They say, obviously, well, that is likely true, but unless we see something else, we'll hold off on that because that implies that the Iranians can't figure that out for themselves. But whatever, the bottom line is they're getting it from somewhere, and they are impacting what they are targeting at. It is insanely precise, he says. While neither country has entered the conflict directly, U.S. and Western intelligence agencies report that Beijing and Moscow are providing critical intelligence to Iran. I want to take a bit of that, first of all, but what do you make of this? And the Iranians have been claiming that this was going to be the case for several weeks now, actually a few months, that their more sophisticated missiles were coming that had the ability to change flight. Now it appears that's happening. What is the impact of that on the ground?
I mean, it's enormous. We we put a lot of stock in the ability that when these missiles are launched, that we can figure out generally where they're aiming for. You know, it's interesting that we see a lot of like, oh, Russia and China providing them the targeting data. Like, that'd be one thing if our bases were constantly moving and they needed like really sophisticated real-time intelligence. I think the Iranians already have that capability. But look, you don't need to be a genius to figure out where our bases are. These are the same bases we have been using for decades with some minor changes here and there. And to think that the Iranians don't have sources on the ground, you know, inside all these different countries, to think that you can't pick up us moving military bases, us moving aircraft, us moving, you know, air defense systems via basic satellite imagery. Of course, I don't think the Russians and the Chinese need to give Iran much assistance in this. This is why us trying to fight from these static bases, even if you wanted to continue the war, continuing to try and fight the war from these static bases is absolute stupidity. And anyone recommending that we should continue to fight the war from these bases, even just in terms of offering President Trump like good military advice, I cannot figure out for the life of me why the Department of War or whoever's advising him is saying, yeah, Mr. President, we're going to keep fighting from these known static locations, because the Iranians can hammer them. It just becomes a math problem.
And, you know, and I don't even know what it is that they're doing there. I know early in the war, there was lots of information that we had evacuated many of these bases. I guess we took some troops out, but obviously some are still there. And I've got to wonder, what are they doing there that they can't do literally anywhere else with technology, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I think early in the war, we started moving a lot of our troops away from the ones that were closer to Iran, like in Bahrain, Qatar, and Kuwait as well. But we're still in Kuwait in some way, shape, or form. And we've moved a lot of our, I think, more critical assets further away. That's why the Iranians are showing us that, like, hey, you can move them to Jordan, but we can still reach them. Again, which is why the naval forces make me very nervous as well. So I agree with you. We proved with Midnight Hammer, and we've proved with the investments that we've made in over-the-horizon technologies and our ability to project force, that we don't need to have our troops in these bases. Even if your desire is to continue to show Iran every now and again that you can still strike them and to do meaningful strikes, we can launch those from outside the range that Iran has. I don't understand why we're leaving troops there. The only reason I can think of, and this is pretty dark, to leave our troops there is that so we take more casualties and we get locked further into this blood debt where we can't leave because our guys have gotten killed, and then now we can't surrender, we can't retreat because that's going to look like we're surrendering. When, again, like even in terms of just giving him good military advice, empty out these bases so Iran has nothing to shoot at, and then shoot at them from our platforms that can project power. I'm advocating for us just to walk away and not continue the war, but just tactically speaking, our actions here are incredibly stupid, and I don't think we're this dumb, so I do feel like to a certain extent, we are allowing our guys to be left in harm's way, basically to be human tripwires to further justify expanding this war.
Okay, you know, I hear that from a number of people, and I've got to ask the logical follow-on question. Why would anyone, whether it's this so-called global elite that's pulling strings in the Pentagon, I don't know, somebody in the Pentagon, I mean, they're the ones that actually have command authority over these things. What is the value when every one of them, I mean, I can't imagine anyone in the Pentagon of any rank cannot see, we can't destroy a granite mountain with a Tomahawk or JASSM cruise missile, period. We just can't. We've tried it. It didn't work. We tried it dozens of times, scores of times on a couple of these specific mountains. It didn't work. So you know you're not going to be able to benefit it. And you see that the stockpiles are dwindling down. Why do I want the war to continue on? Because we're going to get to a point, Joe, to where we don't even have, we may literally run out of these things and have to go to, who knows, a bunch of dumb bombs or whatever, which will be a lot less effective. What is the intent to keep going?
Unfortunately, I think the Pentagon, just because of decades of rewarding people who always say yes and say that we can keep doing this and don't provide ground truth, I think the Pentagon is just saying like, okay, well, if you want to continue to fight from these locations, then, you know, we'll just keep resupplying them, even though our stocks are dwindling, even though there's no actual strategic plan to advance our objectives. None of that work has actually been done. I think you just simply have a bunch of people who are saying like, well, if the president wants us to stay in this war, you know, yes, sir, three bags full, we will just kind of stay in this conflict. And then no one really has the audacity, I think, to go to President Trump and to say like, hey, our military plan here has reached its limit of effectiveness. all you're going to do is get more guys killed, which is going to make us have to double and triple down. And I also think the White House is just terrified of the optics of having to actually pull our troops out. I think that they're more concerned. They're willing to leave our guys over there. They're willing to take casualties because they don't want to get hit here politically back in the States from either the Democrats or other people who are against President Trump by, you know, saying or having them say that Trump is retreating from the region, even though even if you wanted to continue the fight, pulling our troops out of these bases makes the most sense. I simply think that they're there because we don't have the political strength to say we're pulling our guys out of the region because we don't want it to look like we're surrendering. This is a really lethal combo, I think, of just weak leaders at CENTCOM and then also at CENTCOM and the Pentagon, and then also letting basically the public relations wing, the political wing of the White House run the war and give President Trump his advice.
Now, you told us in a previous visit to our show here that prior to the start of the war, when you were still inside government, that there were plenty of people, intelligence and military, that said this is not going to work. Taking out the leader is not going to cause them to collapse. They're not going to come join us. They're going to take the Strait of Hormuz, all that kind of stuff. And then you said that slowly, you being one of them, were denied permission to even talk to President Trump. He started surrounding himself with the yes men. That's what, and I know you're not in there now, but if you have any context or what's your understanding since that time, now that it's clear, especially after the 40 days of bombing didn't work, the couple of months of the blockade didn't work, now the MOU wasn't satisfactory, surely there are more people around him now that can get in that can tell him this is not going to work. You can say whatever you want. We're going to show you some things he said literally just an hour or so ago from the Oval Office. You can say that, and that'll work, relatively speaking, for today. But even he has to understand, and so do these people inside, that I doubt that's going to get to November, if that's what your objective is. So what is your understanding of how things are working inside the Pentagon? I'm sorry, inside the White House, in terms of people telling President Trump the truth?
Well, when the MOU first came out and was floated, it seemed like there was a dose of reality there. The things that the vice president was coming out and saying publicly to kind of justify the MOU. And then a lot of what the president was saying about Israel's actions and why we needed the MOU. I mean, the president was like, he had a moment of clarity where he said, like, we have to do the MOU because of the energy crisis that will unfold if we don't get the Straits of Hormuz open back up. And he stopped just short of saying that, like, you know, we had kind of ran out of military options, but it was pretty obvious that's why we were into the MOU, hence having the need to open up the Straits of Hormuz. So it seemed like we had a brief period there where reality was getting through to the president. He was speaking in very realistic terms. The vice president was speaking in realistic terms. But then we saw the backlash from the pro-Israel lobby and then from a lot of the war hawks here who were attacking the vice president. There were a lot of them who had been, you know, very supportive of the president when he was bombing Iran. They came back out against the president. And then in very short order, they dispatched Marco Rubio over to Lebanon to basically cut a parallel deal that basically negated a large portion of the MOU. And then we tried this thing where we were escorting ships or telling ships they could come through without coordinating with the Iranians, which was in the MOU. So then the Iranians started shooting at, you know, the ships, and that basically brought us back to where we are right now. So we went from being very realistic, realizing why we needed the MOU, to very quickly working against our own stated objective, which was to open the Straits of Hormuz. We should not have let Rubio go over there and cut that side deal that basically made us play referee in Lebanon and allowed Israel to stay in Lebanon. And then we did the thing with where we're going to encourage some of the ships to come through without coordinating first with the Iranians, which was in the MOU. So now we're back to this la-la land fantasy world where we think that we can just bomb Iran until they tap, until the regime collapses. We're back to basically a bombing campaign in search of a strategy, which is just a recipe for a mass casualty event that eventually gets us sucked further into the war, or something else I fear that's being foreshadowed heavily right now by the Israeli leadership.
Yeah, and I do want to hit that stuff you said some developments today. I want to hit on that from Israel. But I want to stick on the point you just made here, because this is what Barak Ravid, and he gets a lot of information from the White House, sometimes from President Trump himself. And he posted this earlier today, that President Trump is approaching a crossroads in the war against Iran as a senior American and Israeli officials claim that he faces only two realistic options. One, promoting a new 10-day ceasefire designed to lead to the reopening of the strait. And that's kind of, I think, the truth scenario where we realize we can't do anything and we acknowledge it. Or two, launching a new and far-reaching military campaign together with Israel aimed at forcing Tehran to surrender. What worries me a lot about that is that somebody thinks that's actually an option, the second one, where we can force them to surrender. If we could, tell me what you think, if we had the capacity, even a 20% chance capacity to actually force Iran to surrender, we would have been all in right now. How do you see that?
I agree with you. However, I think Trump's initial limitations was no boots on the ground, and then someone may have talked him into boots on the ground. I'm not exactly sure what that pilot recovery mission was, if that was something else, or if we just end up losing a pilot and we got a taste of how challenging ground operations could be. And then President Trump said, okay, like no boots on the ground, maybe just bomb. That didn't work. We got the MOU. But I think now that he knows the diplomatic track it's pretty much dead, because the Iranians have said, and they've been really, really clear, that they're not going to give us concessions at the negotiating table that we couldn't extract from them, you know, on the battlefield. And the Iranians are especially galvanized after we killed the supreme leader, after the funeral. So I think he knows the diplomatic track is dead. So I am concerned that he is going to be sold what was just in that tweet from Barak Ravid, where we are going to join into some new campaign with the Israelis, which that opens to me that potentially it opens up like all kinds of bad options. We either are going to try boots on the ground, which I think would be catastrophic. We've talked about that before, but also you have that statement in conjunction with what Smotrich said yesterday, which was that Israel didn't have a desire in joining in a contained or constrained campaign with the Americans. At the same time, strategically, the Israelis have leaked to the Wall Street Journal that the enriched uranium is now in Pickaxe Mountain. Just last week, you had Netanyahu talking about how he's recently visited, what do they call it, the textile factory in Des Moines, basically referencing their nuclear program and that it's still alive and well. I am afraid, because the longer that you play out the lack of military solutions that there are, I am afraid that the Israelis basically are saying, hey, if you give us the nod and the wink and you look the other direction, we will, you know, employ a nuclear weapon. Basically, the statements yesterday by Smotrich say that, hey, we're not with America anymore, which would give the president plausible deniability to say, like, hey, if the Israelis do something in Iran, they even came out and said they weren't part of our constrained campaign. I don't know. They're their own country. They went and did their own thing. So that is my concern. I mean, I know when this whole thing started, it seemed like we were a long ways away from weapons of mass destruction being used. But when the goal is some kind of complete surrender from the Iranians, the more that you do the math, you arrive at weapons of mass destruction, you know, pretty quickly. And now the Israelis are basically saying we could do it on our own. And they're also saying, you know, that enriched uranium that America can't get and take care of, it's buried in Pickaxe Mountain. So I hope I'm wrong, but this is some, I think, pretty clear foreshadowing that could pretty quickly put us in a very dangerous spot.
You know, it's hard for me to fathom a couple of things. First of all, because this is not the first time here, and even in the last couple of weeks, where Israeli figures, and I want to say Netanyahu was one of them, but it was one of the senior officials, are like, no, we're perfectly content for America to be fighting this. And that made me mad. I'll just tell you, because they, the ones that got us to go fight their war that we never needed to fight, is antithetical to our interests, much less not for it. And now then they've got the thing started and they're just sitting back going, yeah, you guys go, you suffer the casualties, you lose your missiles, you lose your troops. No problem. You keep going on. I'm just going to sit back here. It's best for me. And we're okay with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, especially after we lost troops this last weekend, for them to come out and say that's a smack in the face, which to me, there wouldn't be a reason for them to say that right now unless they were planning something, and then unless they did want to give us a veneer, you know, some sort of a plausible deniability where it's like, well, the Israelis already publicly said they're not part of our constrained campaign. We're the ones being constrained. We're the ones doing deliberate, you know, military strikes on military targets. So now if Israel flies off the handle and does something crazy that we would never sign off on, then we can say like, hey, we can point that statement and be like, well, you know, Smotrich already said that they weren't part of the constrained campaign. I just don't see any other reason for Smotrich to put out a statement like that. And that was probably approved at a fairly high level because it came through, through one of the Israeli, basically, pro Israel media heads there. And that's been put out there. So I just, I don't see it. I don't see why they would do that. Unless they wanted to basically give us some sort of plausible deniability for what they're about to do.
You know, I've heard from three very distinct sources in different parts of the world in the last 5 to 6 days that says that they're hearing rumors through their sources or rumblings that there could be a Iranian detonation of a nuclear weapon. Whether they got it from North Korea, whether it's one they made their own, or whether the Israelis are right here and they've actually been making one at Pickaxe Mountain ever since last year, and who knows what's going on, whatever the face is, that they would do that as a means to demonstrate we have a nuclear weapon, to forestall the potential for what you're talking about, so that Israel would then know that if you fire a nuclear weapon, you're going to get one back in return. As our missiles are showing, you're not going to stop it. What is your next play, et cetera? How much credibility do you give to that? And are you concerned about that?
I'm not as concerned about it because I number one, I don't think the Iranians are there. I believe where the USIC was at when I left the administration, that even best case scenario, even pre-Midnight Hammer, they wouldn't have been able to sprint to actually develop a nuclear weapon and get it on a delivery system. But even if, let's say that's all wrong, I think if nothing else, the Iranians in this last iteration of the war, they have shown that they are very, very aware of public messaging, and they right now are winning the information war. They're winning the PSYOP campaign, whatever you want to call it, everything from the Lego videos all the way to the public statements that Iranian diplomats put out right now. So I don't think that they would do that, because then that would prove the justification that us and the Israelis had for attacking them. So I think even if they did have that capability, I think that they would hide it away for quite some time. They have proven that basically by dispersing and having a very, very deep bench, that they can kind of withstand anything that we throw at them. So I think at this point, they value their ability to say, hey, we're not the aggressors. We're defending our country, and we are defending even Hezbollah. We're even defending, you know, the Palestinians, but we are not the aggressors. We are kind of the good guys here. And so I think Iran actually values that narrative more than they value deterrence at this point, because again, like, the Iranians have done a very good job of dispersing all their different capabilities, dispersing their leadership, showing depth in their leadership. So I think right now Iran feels like they can withstand whatever it is that we throw at them, and then militarily, but then in terms of messaging, they can also end up on top in the long run, in the long game.
Well, in fact, you talk about the messaging. Here is Ghalibaf. This was yesterday. On his messaging campaign, he said, Americans keep bringing new military equipment to the region and claim they're after stopping the war. They bet on our intelligence being as brief as their own IQ. We've reached the stage of mastery in recognizing these American games. And on that basis, we've prepared ourselves, which is what you just said. Actions must confirm claims, not contradict them. Because this, you know, that's, I think, part of this whole idea that, is there going to be a 10-day ceasefire? Are we going to get back into that to try and again go back to the MOU? The Iranian side is saying, we're still willing to talk about that. I actually saw Abbas Araghchi say he actually had a 10% chance that we could get back, which surprised me, because I thought it was somewhere a little south of zero. But whatever, he gives it 10, so they're talking here. But with a huge caveat that something has to be given up front, apparently more than it did the MOU. Do you think there actually is a 10% chance?
I agree with you that 10% is pretty optimistic. I just, from everything that Iran has been through right now, I would hate to be the Iranian diplomat having to sell another ceasefire to the Iranians. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Even if Araghchi's like, I'm hoping for 10%, like, he's got like the entire IRGC that's like, hey man, like, we've tried this before. They've attacked us during every single negotiation. They are the ones that said the MOU is done, and the Iranians feel like they're winning on the battlefield. And then, you know, we don't set ourselves up for success. I mean, Golubov basically pointed out what we were just talking about. He's like, the Americans say they're leaving, but we're watching them bring more stuff into the region. Well, I mean, we do a horrible job of bringing more stuff into the region because we fly it into the same stupid known bases we've been operating out of now for decades. Right. So like, dude, the Iranians, do they need satellites or do they really just need to pay off like whatever shepherd is closest to the airfield who gives them a call or posts a video on Twitter? Like, I mean, I don't know. We're fighting like we still control the air. We have complete air and information domination as we did at the beginning of the war on terror. That drives me crazy from just like a tactical perspective. But I don't know. 10%, I think, is pretty optimistic. I personally believe, and I hate saying this, as long as we stay in the region, I think our ability to have any kind of effective diplomacy is very, very limited, if not completely impossible. Now, I think if we did what we have been recommending and pulled our forces out and said, okay, now let's talk about sanctions relief. Now let's really just talk about getting the Straits of Hormuz open. We're not here as the aggressors anymore. We're also going to restrain Israel. Then I think we would have a chance to kind of have that diplomatic reset. It's still going to be tough. I mean, I don't think we have fully internalized or really understood just what we've done to the Iranian people and how we have probably bought the revolutionary government there that in theory we want to overthrow, how we've probably just bought them at least another 47 years by killing the supreme leader and having everyone rally around the flag.
By the way, we have Suleiman Ahmed, who was recently in Iran and actually had an interview with Ismail Baghaei, their foreign ministry spokesman, an amazing interview. He's going to be on with us this afternoon at 3 p.m. and he's going to tell us exactly what the people, because he interviewed a bunch of just regular people with no minders or anything else. So he said he got a lot of interesting information about what they think. We'll see that at 3 o'clock this afternoon. I want to go to something that President Trump said just a couple of hours ago, maybe less than that, and from the Oval Office. Now, this first soundbite I'm going to show you can almost be taken two different ways. My optimistic ear wants to hear him laying a foundation or relaying one that could, if it's used properly, do the walkaway plan. What do you think?
If we left today, it would take them decades to rebuild. And I don't believe they could ever rebuild. And honestly, they haven't seen anything yet. We've been nice.
So, yeah, so apparently we could do a lot more than some of these other sound bites are going to imply that is what's coming. But he said up to this point, he goes, hey, you know, we could, if we left today, it's going to take them decades and we've won, et cetera. Any chance he could use that to worm his way into a victory narrative to walk away?
He 100% could. I mean, I joke every time he lists off everything we've bombed and then he says stuff like that. If you just cranked up like the Trump rally YMCA music, like literally it could be his victory parade. And I'm like, I'm not even kidding. Like it totally could be. He says these things out loud and I get excited because I'm like, just do it, man. Like you can shape a narrative. What I think Trump is like, he doesn't realize yet that he can will things into existence here in America by saying them, but it doesn't work like in a shooting battle against a real country like Iran. So he should lean into his strengths, like pull everybody out and just say, we set them back 25 years. We destroyed their Navy. I killed all these different leaders and have a Trump rally about it. You know, do it on the White House lawn with a UFC fight and a flyover. Like, he can control that narrative and then he can move on to everything else. And then quietly we get the Straits of Hormuz open. Hopefully we stabilize the, you know, the energy prices, et cetera. But I just, every time I get optimistic like that, we end up kind of doubling back down. So again, this kind of goes back to who's giving him the advice and is he listening to that advice? Or is his pride going to kind of outweigh his more pragmatic side? I do feel like he's playing around with it right there. When he says things like that, he is giving himself an off ramp. So I'm right there with you. Like, I hope optimistically that becomes a narrative and that's what he leans into. But unless he starts pulling guys out, I don't see it happening right now.
Yeah, not right now, but because he's made that comment for many weeks now, and I keep hoping that's where he's going. And then he goes back and just says, you know, we're going to hit him worse. For example, one of the other things that he's talking about here, and you mentioned a second ago that there was an Israeli an intel release yesterday or leak or whatever the phrase was that they used, that actually I know that President Trump has said that those three sites that we destroyed in Operation Midnight Hammer and have satellites on them and they haven't dug them out. Well, it turns out they're actually in Pickaxe Mountain.
Do you believe that Iran has moved nuclear centrifuges into Pickaxe Mountain? And when you say we're not done yet, what is left to finish?
Well, I think that they may have. We don't have it on record, all we do is read the fake news. You know, we see the news is so wrong so many times. So, you know, maybe this one they have right, but it's okay. It doesn't mean anything unless they have the material. You're talking about the centrifuges. Yeah, it doesn't mean anything unless they have the material. They don't have. We follow the material. That's where the action is, and we'll be hitting that area probably pretty soon. And there's not a thing they can do about it. You know, normally I wouldn't say that. If I thought they could do something about it, I would never say that. But we'll be hitting that area pretty soon, and very heavily.
Now, he is right about that last part. The air defense, the anti-missile defense that the Iranians have is almost just inconsequential. They knock out some MQ-9 Reapers. They've hit a few other aircraft, but in terms of the overall sortie rate, it's pretty low. So he's probably right. The missiles can go and hit whatever they want. But I'm not sure he's right that there's nothing that they can do about it. First of all, what do you think about the idea of striking Pickaxe Mountain? Because I don't know what we could do more to that than we have to Yazd and several of these other mountains. We can hit the surface of it. We can hit whatever buildings on the surface or the exit ramps or something. But what is that going to do for us?
This is the problem with the whole idea of going after the enriched uranium. And this is why the Israelis, they love this concept. Because Trump did, I think his attempt with Midnight Hammer was to take the idea of enrichment kind of off the table, but the Israelis came back, and this is why they wanted to get him on the enriched material, because at some point you can basically never bomb away the enriched material. Like, basically we obliterated the sites, they're non-functional, we set the program back, you know, 25 plus years, but somewhere buried beneath miles of granite there's still some form of nuclear dust of uranium. And so now we have to forever chase the uranium around Iran and continue to bomb, and then eventually, you know, you don't fully take care of that problem until you put boots on the ground and you physically control it. The Iranians like making that the goal, or I'm sorry, the Israelis like making that the gold standard. This is why we should have never even tolerated this as an objective that we are going after. The Iranians had committed they didn't want a nuclear weapon. We bombed the three sites. They were obliterated for all intents and purposes, and we should have never spoken about it again. But now the Israelis are playing this game where they can get the media spun up, they can fearmonger, they can have all their talking heads go out there and say, Pickaxe Mountain, Pickaxe Mountain, they've moved the enriched centrifuges. Even though, like President Trump just said, we've got satellites trained on those three locations. They didn't dig, you know, a mile deep into the buried granite and rubble to dig out the enriched material that they had. I think that he shouldn't even tolerate this, because this is literally the enriched uranium idea. It's either a poison pill to kill any negotiations if we say they can't have any, but if we're forever chasing it and we're forever trying to get the nuclear dust, that is going to commit us basically to an endless war inside of Iran. So he shouldn't even like tolerate this talk, because it's going to make him chase an objective that we will never achieve.
You know, and then let's look also that there's a cost to that. And I don't think enough people recognize that. I showed you a second ago this idea that some of the Americans are saying that, you know, the Iranians are having advanced capabilities now with changing trajectory in flight, which messes up our intel or our radar system to even give warnings on the ground. That's not the only thing, though. This is a map of some of the American sites that have been hit just in that 7-day period there from the 12th to the 19th of July. And you see that they're hitting all kinds of stuff here. And a lot of these are multiple hits. So they are hitting things left and right all across the entire region. And then here, they're also hitting our regional allies here, Kuwait. This is again today. Their water and energy infrastructure were again hit today, as Iran keeps saying, hey, we're going to continue going down the way that we want. And then now it's not just a Strait of Hormuz that's got to be opened up. Now it's the Bab al-Mandab, at least to Saudi oil. And according to information we have this morning, there has been two tankers that did turn around. So now then there are many tankers left. According to information I have, there were a number of vessels that did transit today, but the Saudi tankers, the ones with crude oil, did not. They actually turned around after receiving direct threats from the Houthis. So that is going to be a real problem, because somewhere between, depending on what day of the week it is, it's 4 to 7 million barrels per day have gone through that strait from Saudi Arabia. And if people think maybe the Suez Canal in the north, that's very limited. I didn't realize this until just recently, but because of the tonnage and the weight, that most of these VLCCs can't transit that way. They have to, some smaller ships they can get through, but then the volume is going to go down. But even that is limited. So it's the Bab al-Mandab, almost or nothing. Are you worried about this?
Very worried about it. One of the lifelines we've had while the Straits of Hormuz was shut down is that Yanbu pipeline that goes out of Saudi, goes to the Yanbu port there on the Red Sea. And then it was sending, you know, the major tanker traffic, like you said, through the Bab el-Mandeb south to, you know, to Asia. Some of it would go north. And then if they're already starting to turn around the Saudi tankers, now we've got yet another problem. We have another major oil and energy choke point that is now being restricted. And the Houthis are keeping it limited, it seems like, to the Saudis for now. They could expand that. But basically, it's just them turning around the Saudis. That's going to have a massive effect, because now we're going to further restrict the amount of oil that's going to reach it out into the market. People need to keep in mind, it's easy to forget now because things move so quickly. In 2025, we tried to fight the Houthis. We tried to get rid of the you know, air quotes, Houthi problem, and we couldn't do it militarily. We had to quietly, you know, cut some kind of a deal with them where they said they would open the straits back up. But that was after we spent a lot of military resources and we had to move a lot of our naval vessels actually out of the Red Sea, out of the Straits of Hormuz area, because of the capabilities of the Houthis. People don't realize just how mountainous and high those cliffs are in Yemen, how many caves there are. It's an ideal place to defend and fight and be able to shoot down into the Red Sea. So now we have a problem that we couldn't solve when we had the problem isolated in 2025. We weren't fighting a war anywhere else in 2025. Couldn't solve it militarily there. And then now we've also got the Straits of Hormuz that we can't militarily solve. So now we've got two key choke points that are being restricted at the same time. And so we're trying to apply the exact same tools that are now spread even thinner to solve the problem that we couldn't solve before. So again, even just from a purely military standpoint, like, this strategy does not make any sense whatsoever.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because President Trump was asked about that today, and he, with his characteristic dismissal, said, oh, those Houthis, we solved that problem last time.
What is your level of concern of a blockade of the Red Sea by the Houthi rebels, opening up another front in the war?
This is what happens. So far, it hasn't happened, might happen. But we take care of things. If something like that happens, we take care of it. You know, we've done that with the Houthis before, and we haven't heard from them in a while since we did what we did originally. That was about 45 days of very powerful action we took against the Houthis. And we've had no problem with the Houthis. They've had no problem with us for a long period of time, including during this conflict. I think that if there is something like that, we'll just have to take care of business.
Yes, it's no big deal, Joe. We'll just take care of business. That'll be fine. We did it before. What do you say to that?
I wish it were true. I mean, it's just, unfortunately, it's not. If the Houthis want to shut that down, they've proven that they can. At the same time, the Houthis have proven that they can be pragmatic. But at the same time, like, this was before we killed the Supreme Leader. This was before Israel was making even more incursions into Lebanon. The Houthis and the Iranians very much view themselves right now as the resistance, as the people that are going to, you know, set the Islamic countries, they're going to save the Islamic countries of the region, you know, from us. So in a way, we're trying to apply like very basic Western logic to the situation. But even then, like, we militarily couldn't take care of that business. We kind of had to, you know, cut side deals here and there. So everybody loves President Trump's confidence. I just don't think that it's going to stand up to the Houthis. It's not going to stand up to the Iranians if they decide to make this very, very painful. And like, look, the Iranians are incentivized to do everything they can right now with the Houthis to make it so that they do restrict the flow of oil to put pressure on President Trump. And then something else that happened, I think, right after the Ayatollah's funeral is the Houthis sent a delegation to Tehran, and then the Saudis tried to stop the delegation from landing back inside of Yemen, and the Saudis couldn't do that. And the Saudis actually went and got pretty aggressive with some of their strikes. They hit Sana'a International. The Houthis rerouted that plane and landed it out in Hodeidah, which is closer to the Red Sea, which just shows their degree of control over that Red Sea area. But I don't think the Saudis would have gotten aggressive against the Houthis and restarted that war if they didn't think that the Houthis were going to enter the war in a meaningful way. So there's something else that's happening, I think, but below the surface that we're not quite seeing yet. But the Saudis have not been eager to fight the Houthis like this for quite some time, because the Houthis, again,
for good reason.
For good reason, yeah, they've been a pain in their rear for, you know, now over a decade. Well over a decade now at this point, even with our assistance. So the days of the Houthis sitting this out, I think, are limited. Exactly when they're going to get fully involved and to what degree, I don't know. But if we've already got two ships that had Saudi oil on them turning around, it's not trending positively.
And there was a piece in Responsible Statecraft today by one of our periodic guests here, Rosemary Kalanick, one of my colleagues at Defense Priorities as well. And she says the Houthi blockade could potentially put Trump in a serious bind. She says she sees a couple of different ways. I'd like your view on these two. She says it could either put pressure on Trump by threatening economic calamity through the skyrocketing oil prices, which means it's putting pressure on him to do exactly what you suggest, which is the claim victory and walk away thing, because we just can't win the war this way. Or by the Iranian side, pressuring the Saudis to disallow the use of their bases and airspace for attacks, potentially in exchange for allowing some of their oil to go through. How do you see those two potential pressures acting on the president?
I think they're both, you know, well within the realm of what's going to happen here shortly. I mean, we already saw two ships have already turned around. So that economic pressure is going to start now. Could they make it worse? Absolutely. But the Saudis are pretty good at hedging their bets. And we already saw the Saudis sent a delegation to the Supreme Leader's funeral. And before, the Saudis had advocated for us to, you know, finish the job in Iran. They were very hawkish when they thought that we were going to come in there and just hammer them. But now that they see that, you know, we're not 10 feet tall and bulletproof, that we have limitations, that the Iranians have fared very well, I do see the Saudis probably doing some more hedging as well. And the Saudis have been a little bit hot and cold with us using a lot of their airspace to launch attacks, because when a lot of their infrastructure started getting hit inside Saudi Arabia. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Saudis just said, like, hey, America. And I think a lot of our partners are going to start doing this quietly in the Gulf. I think maybe the Kuwaitis are probably next. They're going to start quietly saying, like, you need to not use our territory so much anymore, or at all.
At all.
We'd love to keep you as a friend, but you're not as good of a friend as we thought you are. We have to remember here that, like, basically our security guarantees, us saying that we would protect all of these different, all the GCC states, that was what underpinned the petrodollar, but that was what justified our existence in the region. And also the GCC states, as much as we had some problems here and there with them, they were actually pretty grateful for our military being there. When we basically called the bluff and we couldn't provide those security guarantees, we're left short and we're left without a lot of leverage. So when the president projects that much confidence, again, this is where I kind of wonder, like, is he actually getting a realistic assessment? I mean, is he hearing from the people who are talking to the leadership, you know, or the guys that are just below the leadership? Because a lot of just, you know, pleasantries that happen between heads of state, I can easily see where, you know, the leaders of the GCC countries, if they do meet with President Trump or have a phone call with them, that it's very, you know, polite, very formal. But then quietly, their ministers of defense go to our guys in the region and say, oh, and by the way, you can't launch any attacks from here. I just wonder if that's making it back to the president, so he realizes just kind of how limited our options are.
Well, I'll tell you one thing working against that. You said at the beginning of this show, you were talking about the information campaign that we're no longer in. We still think it's like Desert Storm time, where we can control all the airwaves. Apparently we're unaware that there is a social media now that are putting information out there, or shows like ours here that we're talking. But everybody is not aware of that. Some people are still thinking that it's the old way. And President Trump, because he still does the old way, he probably isn't watching our show. At least I doubt that he is. But he does watch Fox News almost religiously, maybe intravenously even. And I want to show you something that was said yesterday. I think it was by Jim Carafano. And if President Trump is watching and listening to this kind of thing, one may wonder, is he actually acting on it?
I know people are fixated by the losses, which are terrible, and how long this has taken, but our position in the region is the strongest that it's been since the end of World War II. I mean, we have been dealing with this from Jimmy Carter. Since the days of Jimmy Carter, we have never had a position in the region this strong to create a better future for the region. And then that means less trouble for us, less work for us, safer America. And I just think that this is it, the price we are paying. Trust me, it is going to pay off for decades.
What kind of planet can this guy be on? The strongest since World War II? I mean, I did a show. I just went crazy about this morning. I mean, just look at how many aircraft we've lost, how many bases we've had wiped out, how many troops we've had killed, the problems that we're having in the Strait of Hormuz, now the Bab el-Mandab. And you want to tell me that we're in the strongest position now? You just said a second ago, we're probably going to face a case where our allies are going to start telling us, yeah, why don't you kind of move on somewhere else? What is your reaction to that?
Man, geez, so many feelings. You know, when I hear Fox News nowadays, I almost feel like I'm back for the first time in language school, hearing like a foreign language, like hearing Pashtun for the first time. It's just so almost unrecognizable to me. And look, this would all be just like kind of white noise because who cares about network news? However, you're right. The president does watch Fox News and he does care what they say. And that's exactly why the neocons are putting forward someone with these laughable talking points to tell the president what he wants to hear. And this is incredibly dangerous. Like, it'd be fine for the president to get this perspective every now and again, as long as it was immediately followed up by someone who could fact check, like you just did in 30 seconds, what the crazy guy from the Heritage Foundation just said. But I don't think that's happening. I hope it is, but I fear it's not, because the president is continuing to project confidence. And again, this kind of goes back to, like, we got into the MOU because there was no military solution. Then we threw out the MOU, and now we're back to trying to affect some kind of a military solution.
Oh my Lord.
Gosh. I didn't even see that. Yeah. See, this is the problem. This is the problem. And someone should be honest enough with the emperor, who clearly has no clothes, to come up to him when he posts something like this and be like, "Hey, sir, we've got to get you smart on this stuff." And
by
like,
the way, an 80-year-old emperor with no clothes, that's bad, man.
That's the analogy. You can't just keep saying that things are going great. You have to say, "Mr. President, I respect you, and you know, I want you to be successful. This is very dangerous. Everything that the highly respected James Cafaro just said is we can refute that right now. It is just completely wrong." So he doesn't just think we're doing great. Like, this echo chamber is absolutely lethal for our troops in the region and for our country in the long run. And, you know, comically, like, pretty hilarious.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
And I'll tell you somebody who's not. Last one here. Gary, let's play the one here in a second called Rubio Shipping. This is Rubio a couple of days ago. And if you're looking for somebody on the inside to be able to refute this, it ain't going to come from Marco Rubio, who here's what he had to say about the problem we had with the shipping now in the both the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandab.
But other countries think we begin to step up and provide whether it's hardware or finances to help carry that burden. It is not the United States' job to protect shipping from the entire planet forever.
I mean, come on, man. It's not our job to do everybody else's job. Oh, wait. We started this war, and that's why there's a need for this. How's that going to go over?
I like it how neocons go from being very, very hawkish until everything blows up in their face, and then they finally get like a little dose of realism. Like, yes, I agree with you, Mr. Secretary, that our job is not to provide the security guarantees for the entire world and to guarantee the safety of shipping lanes. However, when we're the ones that screwed up the shipping lanes, like, no one's going to come try and bail us out. So the administration really needs to do some serious self-reflection right now on where we're at and how we get out of here, because these statements are just they're off the wall. And it just shows, kind of like you said, it shows that there probably is not anyone there telling the president the actual truth. If that's what Marco Rubio is going into the White House and telling the president behind closed doors as his national security advisor and his secretary of state, well, it's no wonder we are where we are in this mess.
Really well said. And last question I got for you, going back to this Barak Ravid here, if this is right and they're saying that you've got two choices, either go to a 10-day ceasefire, which I can't see because he would have to submit and concede some things, or going back to a new far-reaching military campaign, what do you think is going to happen here in the next week or 10 days?
That's why I think we're in a really dangerous spot. I mean, I think the Iranians do rightfully fear that the Israelis might do something drastic, like use a nuclear weapon or something else. And so that's going to incentivize the Iranians to do more of what they did in Jordan. Again, I hope the 10% that Arachi gave it works out and we go into another ceasefire. But the way that the president is talking and the way that the last ceasefire just didn't work out, I'm very concerned. I think these next 10 days are going to be very dangerous. I think every day that we're there in this state where we're still shooting at each other, it just gets more and more dangerous, you know, by the second, because, you know, like we learned in our own combat experiences, like we have to be lucky every single second of every single day. The enemy only has to be lucky once for the entire calculus to change. And the Israelis right now, the things that they're doing, the things that they're telegraphing make me, you know, incredibly nervous. And then what we were just laughing about, because it's so absurd, the advice the president is getting, I just don't think that he's in a space where he's having to make these really hard decisions, because he's being told, you know, by crazy people on Fox News that everything is going great and we're in the best position we've been in since World War II. So incredibly dangerous times.
Indeed it is. We'll continue to watch, but we really appreciate you coming on in with these insights here, and especially what some of the interpretations, some of the things Israel's been saying. I was not tracking on that, and now our viewers are as well. Thank you very much for coming on, Joe. Always a pleasure to have you.
Great to be with you, man. Thanks for having me.
And we appreciate you guys, too. And by the way, we still got two more shows today here in just about 10 minutes. We're actually going to have for the first time on Professor Nikolai Petro, who is an expert in the Russia-Ukraine war, has written a number of books and is very, very knowledgeable about all the things going on there. Do turn in this, because he's going to talk about the Russia-Ukraine war. Will drones decide the war? What is the physical evidence showing? You're going to want to tune into that. And then at 3 o'clock this afternoon, Suleiman Ahmed, who I just said had an exclusive interview with the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, as well as some others that he's got coming up, which he'll give us a preview on as well. A lot of interesting information, things that he's gotten on the ground in Iran that you are definitely going to hear as it pertains to where this war could go. See you then at 2 o'clock and at 3 o'clock on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.